All right, we've, the parties have suggested that we begin in open court, which we will. We're going to depend, you want to call the name of the case, huh? Or have you done? You did, okay. So, we're going to depend on the parties who know the record better than we do to be sure that only unclassified information is discussed in open court. And then we'll make a judgment about whether to continue in closed court, although it seems to me that at least some of the information is unlikely to be able to be discussed in open court. But we'll see as it goes. All right, we'll hear from Mr. Neff.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Neff from the Schiff Hardin Law Firm with Don Klein, also from Schiff Hardin on behalf of Petitioner Mashour Al-Sabri. With the Court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, there are three issues I'd like to address in my presentation this morning. First, the District Court committed legal error in deeming itself bound by earlier dicta from this Court concerning the weight to be given to guest house and training camp evidence. Second, the Court made a number of clear factual errors that played an important role in its ruling. And third, the Court's failure to view the evidence as a whole. Turning to the first of these issues, the District Court's conclusions regarding the significance of guest house and training camp allegations was directly at odds with the record in this case, including the 9/11 report. Now, Mr. Al-Sabri did not dispute that he briefly stayed at two guest houses in Afghanistan that, according to the government's evidence, had some connection to the Taliban and perhaps Al-Qaeda. Mr. Al-Sabri certainly, however, did dispute that he ever obtained military training in Afghanistan or anywhere.
Is there a larger number of places involved than the two? Four, perhaps?
There are. There was a house in Pakistan. There are a larger number.
So is it only two that are in dispute?
Two that I'm addressing now. I don't know if I can go any further in a non-classified setting, Your Honor.
But would you if we close the court?
Yes.
Or do you, in your brief, remind me, you do all four. All four are disputed.
Yes. The District Court's decisions focused on my client's acknowledgement of his guest house stays, and the Court then concluded that my client did, in fact, obtain military training in Al-Qaeda-sponsored camp in Afghanistan. Now, then on the question...
Did the Court formulate its decision in the alternative without reference to training camp? And then, in other words, saying even disregarding that?
Well, I think the Court did look at its different findings and conclude that all of them together certainly supported its decision to deny the writ. I think it's clear, however, that each of these specific findings, in particular the guest house and the training camp findings, the Court gave great weight to. The Court indicated in its decision, citing the earlier decisions from this Court, that this was powerful evidence in favor of the government's case.
Right. On the guest houses, you mentioned that two are disputed, but you said, I think, that you would dispute all. Or that you do in your brief dispute all. But I thought that you conceded staying at the four guest houses.
Right, right. It's okay. More the connection that's the issue than his presence there. So the District Court, citing the earlier decisions from this Court, held that this was powerful evidence in favor of the government. And the District Court did not undertake any sort of independent analysis to determine what weight this type of evidence should be given. Rather, it simply adopted the language of the prior rulings of this court and ruled in favor of the government.
On the training question, if we assume for purposes of the discussion that he did attend a training camp, what more should the district court have said other than that it's an, you know, it's a powerful element of evidence that detainee is a part of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, that he attended a training camp of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda? Why isn't that sufficient for him to say? It may not be the end, but why isn't, what's wrong with that statement?
It's completely contrary to the record in this case.
So that's not a legal question, that's a fact question.
Absolutely.
I see.
Absolutely.
Okay. So you're not saying he misunderstood the law, it's that you don't think the facts support that.
Well, no, I think he did misunderstand the law, and that he deemed himself bound by earlier decisions from this court in terms of the significance that evidence should be accorded. Rather than undertake an analysis of the record in this case to say, well, what does the record here show in terms of what attending that training camp means? He didn't do that. He just simply cited the decisions from this court and said, ah, it's powerful evidence, end of story. That's the error.
This is hard. I think this is very hard to discuss hypothetically. I'm getting more and more confident that we're going to need the closed session.
Well, I can get into some of the unclassified evidence right now, specifically the 9/11 report. Look at the 9/11 report. The 9/11 report notes that in the 5 years leading up to 9/11, between 10 and 20,000 men trained at Al-Qaeda-sponsored camps in Afghanistan. The 9/11 report then says that no more than a few hundred of those men went on to become part of Al-Qaeda. So if you run the math there, with the 9/11 commission...
As of the time of the 9/11 report, it's not a statement for all time, is it?
Well, in terms of the time period under consideration...
Were they definitive that those other thousands of people had renounced terrorism, renounced Al-Qaeda? I didn't read the 9/11 report that way.
Well, I think the 9/11 report certainly is powerful evidence on either side here, and I don't think it can be dismissed lightly. And what the 9/11 report said, it was saying, you run the math, that's about 1 in 100 of the men who went to an Al-Qaeda-sponsored camp in Afghanistan wound up joining Al-Qaeda. And when you have that image in your mind, that just can't be squared with the level of significance that the court gave to such evidence.
Was the commission talking about the people who went to the Al-Qaeda camp during the period of the Russian occupation and were fighting against the Russians? Or what period was it talking about?
The five-year period preceding 9/11.
And was it talking about people who were still in Afghanistan after 9/11 or people who had left before? We don't know.
I don't think that's clear from the report. I could be wrong about that. But, you know, it's consistent with the broader story here of what was going on in Afghanistan. You had this long history of Islamic militants going to Afghanistan, you know, early on to fight the Soviets, but continuing that it was sort of a magnet for Arabs or other Muslim men to travel there to obtain military training. And Al-Qaeda had by no means cornered the market on those Islamic militants. They did sponsor camps there. They did have a network of guest houses that supported those camps. But to conclude that simply because somebody was at a camp...
But the court doesn't conclude simply, right? The court lists that as one factor and lists a number of other factors together.
It does, but reading the opinion, I think a fair reading of it is that the training camp evidence alone, the court would have ruled against me.
Mr. Nav, when you said 20,000 or more,
10 to 20,000
attended training camps, but only a small number thereafter did what?
I became part of Al-Qaeda.
But what about the Taliban?
Well, yes, some would have gone to the Taliban as well. That's a fair point, Your Honor.
Perhaps many more.
Well, there is evidence in the record in one of the expert reports indicating that even for the Taliban, it was still a much smaller proportion of that larger number that went there for the training.
Half?
No, I think my recollection is it's much lower than that.
So what'd they do? Just do it as a sort of postgraduate education and then put it away?
Some people went there with something to do, I have no doubt. Others, hey, Bosnia, Chechnya, they went home. They got to go home and, you know, tell their community that they, you know, fulfilled their religious obligation to prepare for a jihad. And, you know, they, and, you know, put your, I think context is critical in these cases. And, you know, if you put yourself in the shoes of a 20-something, you know, Muslim man who grew up in a conservative culture, perhaps, you know, very tight-knit family environment, and you tell him he gets to, you know, go to another country, you know, run around and, you know, learn how to shoot guns, a lot of guys are going to say it sounds like fun.
When was the 9/11 report published?
I don't recall.
Or composed, I should say.
Yeah, I don't recall. I want to say about a year post.
And did it deal with post 9/11 events?
Well, I mean, it certainly derived a substantial portion of its information from detainees who were captured in the invasion of Afghanistan and Pakistan. But whether it addressed world events after 9/11, not that I can recall.
The facts in this case involving purported training camp post-date 9/11, correct?
Yes. I'm sorry. No, they do not. They predate.
When would he have been there if he was there at all?
My client arrived in Afghanistan in the late summer, early fall of 2000. Bombs started falling in October of 2001. You know, according to the government, so his training would have been, you know, sometime earlier in 2001, presumably.
So, okay, earlier in the same year.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And, Your Honors, you know, it's not just the 9/11 report. The record in this case is largely uncontested on this, that, you know, that there was not this strong correlation between training camp attendance and membership in al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And when you sort of back away from that, the correlation for guest house attendance becomes substantially weaker. Your Honor, I'd like to turn to a number of the clear factual errors committed by the district court.
Before you get too far away from this, give me just a second here, because I'm looking at page 1504, looking for it, actually. I think it's paragraph 28. But the,
can I just ask, do we know whether this is classified or?
Well, I wasn't going to go okay. into that.
It's unclassified.
It says unclassified.
Okay. Yeah.
But it says, 27, pardon me, few if any of this group referred to would have even known much of al-Qaeda or been invited to join its inner circle. But I don't see anything about not many going into the Taliban, which I think was a good deal less selective.
I'm sorry, not many what?
Going into the Taliban, which I think was a good deal less selective. And if we look at the last sentence of 1503, the brigade in question goal was to, that's also unclassified, was to help the Taliban crush the pockets of horse-mounted Uzbek guerrilla resistance in the high peaks of the mountains, and to destroy Massoud's resistance. Massoud was the Northern Alliance, I believe. Yeah. Obviously, this large fighting force that was often used as cannon fodder by the Taliban was not privy to the 9/11 plot or other plots, such as the Millennium Plot.
Right.
So apparently, thousands went into the Taliban, not just a small number.
Right. Actually, it's on the prior page, Your Honor, on towards the bottom of page 11. It says the 55 brigade may have eventually swollen to from 3,000 to 5,000 fighters.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, that's the group that then was used in aid or to fight the Northern Alliance.
Right.
But the point is that it's not, it nowhere says that a small number coming out of the training camps ever worked with the Taliban. It may say that with regard to al-Qaeda.
Right. I mean, if you compare the figures here to the 9/11 report, you know, we're talking maybe a third to a half.
Well, that a third of the 10,000 or more, that works.
Right.
Not a small number. Okay.
The district court committed a clear error in this case in referring to a document titled "The List of Arriving Brothers" as a training roster. As the court may recall, this is a document that has a list of names. Next to those names, a list of arrival dates. The government referred to this as an al-Qaeda document. The government contended that one of the people identified on that list was Mr. al-Sabri. We did not dispute that point, but we did contend, or we did not feel that this document really was all that significant, because it was clear this document was nothing more than a list of guest house residents. And in fact, in the proceedings below, the government never argued that this list was anything more than that.
Words in the document, are they classified? I have some questions about that. I want to ask you about that and the other side as well.
That I don't know. They might be, Your Honor.
So I think this one is one we should say. If what you're saying is it's clear error to discuss, to conclude from it that it's a training document, I think the only way we're going to get to it is by talking about what's in it, and it's a little hard to do that.
Okay.
So we will discuss this when we get to the next.
And related to the issue we were discussing earlier, the court also mistakenly concluded that the jihadi tours that we cited in our papers as an explanation for why al-Sabri would have been allowed to the area where Taliban forces were positioned against the Northern Alliance. This kind of ran counter to the government's contention that security was tightly controlled there. The district court simply got it wrong in terms of what the record indicates with regard to the time period these tours were active. The record indicates that it continued up until at least 2000. The court, however, simply held that that the record indicated that they did not continue into the 1990s and 2000s.
I was unsure about the significance. I understand your point, which is to show that some people made it to the front who were not who were tourists, I think Gucci tourists is the way you put it, yeah. But there's no dispute that your client was not a Gucci tourist, right?
Right, we do not claim that he
was. So is there any evidence that anybody, I take it part of the reason the Gucci tourists were allowed to go there is they had a lot of money and they were making contributions. Is there any evidence of any other kind of like thrifty tourists like your like your client? I don't know, Afghanistan on $5 a day tourists. We're able to get to the front, and is that not relevant?
Well, part of my dispute is we dispute that the area that our client visited was actually the front.
That's a different question, I take
but,
it. Yeah.
But specifically as to that, no. I think both sides or the government's argument was really based on speculation here. There's no direct evidence either way, and this is just sort of to counter that speculation. I see that I'm over my time.
All right, we'll hear from the government.
Thank you.
And we'll hear from you again. You may find it, you want to save it for the closing, for the classified session, but you're also, since we held you over, you can have a few minutes in open court if you want.
May it please the court, Michael Labate on behalf of the respondents. Your Honors, I want to begin by focusing on the guest house and the training camp evidence as we can discuss it here in open court and say that it's specifically inculpatory in this case with regards to petitioner. If you look at the four guest houses that are at issue here in the district court's opinion, the first one is in Quetta, Pakistan, and at pages 791 and 804 in the record, the petitioner admits he knew that was a Taliban-run guest house that facilitated travel from Pakistan into Afghanistan. Then the second guest house stay was in Kandahar, the Haji Habash guest house. Again, petitioner admits at 796 and at 817 that he knew that guest house was run by a senior al-Qaeda figure and that it was full of people waiting to go to training camps, such as the Al-Farouk training camp. That's in the unclassified record in this case, and the court below noted that specifically. Third, petitioner then briefly went for a couple of days to Kabul, where he stayed at a guest house run by Hamza al-Ghamdi. Again, it's in the unclassified record that al-Ghamdi was a senior.
Those pages again?
For the
third one.
for the third one, it's at 835 and 939. What those show at 835 and 939 is that petitioner sought the consent of Al-Ghamdi to go to the front lines of the fighting. And as well at page 833, it indicates that his initial stay, which was just 2 days at the Al-Ghamdi guest house, he asked to go to the fighting, was denied permission because he lacked weapons training. He then moves on to Jalalabad and eventually comes back in the middle of 2001. In May 2001, he stays for another week at the Al-Ghamdi guest house, and this time he's granted permission to go to the front lines.
Page?
835.
Sorry. Once again?
835. What happened in between in Jalalabad, the district court found, is that petitioner attended military training. Actually, if you piece this together, it appears that petitioner was sort of moving back and forth between the training camp and the Al-Ghamdi guest house in the front lines. The training records referred, and again, this is all on the unclassified side, the training records referred to a communications course number 2 that petitioner attended in February of 2001. So that's after leaving the Al-Ghamdi guest house the first time in September, October 01, and before returning the second time in May 01. So he's attending that communications course. He also admits that while he was in Jalalabad, he went to the front lines near Kabul. That's at page 804 in the record, and that there was active fighting going on there. He then admits both at pages 810 and at 835. At 835, he said Al-Ghamdi finally authorizes him in May 01 to go to the second line near Bagram to assist the Taliban fighting the Northern Alliance. And again at 8:10, he said he spent a week at the battle lines from Kabul, where the Al-Ghamdi guest house was, to assist the Taliban against the Northern Alliance. And at 9:39, he also admits he received instructions from Al-Ghamdi on training sites and front lines. So we have the first training in February, back to the Al-Ghamdi guest house in May, but, and this is crucial, then in August 2001, it was actually August 24th, 2001, according to the district court's findings, he's back in the training camp. And the letter reveals, and again, this is in the court's opinion, in the unclassified version of the opinion, that he had completed an anti-aircraft missiles course by that point in time and was scheduled to have priority in the upcoming artillery seminar beginning the next day. That's August 24th, 2001, just less than 2 weeks before September 11th. The court has him back in the training camp. This does not show somebody who may have happened to wander in the training camp as cast of thousands and wandered out with no affiliation. It shows somebody who is back and forth between military training, between a guest house run by an admitted Al-Qaeda figure who had responsibility for placing people in camps and in the battlefield positions, back to the training camp to receive advanced training, anti-aircraft missiles, advanced artillery. These were not run-of-the-mill training courses that somebody would just show up and receive. And even evidence submitted by petitioner supports that. There was a declaration from David Hicks, who had a Guantanamo detainee who had been released. I believe it appears at page 1056 in the record, talking about how lots of people received initial training, but only a smaller select group, you know, went back for a more advanced training. So the record supports an inference that the district court gathered here, that petitioner's attendance at the camp was not merely innocent, but was part of his intention to engage in fighting. And it wasn't merely these guest house stays and the training camp stays, which this court has held in numerous cases can be compelling evidence of association with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. There were several other findings as well. While at the guest house, petitioner turned over his passport. This court has repeatedly noted that was standard practice at Al-Qaeda guest houses. While in Kandahar at the Haji Habash guest house, petitioner attended this Islamic institute across the street.
Just hold for 1 second. Did he get his passport back?
It appears that he did, and then surrendered it again in Jalalabad to the person with whom he stayed.
And didn't have it when he was captured?
Correct. Correct. His story, and the judge found this not credible, is that he was waiting.
It can't be enough. I have to admit, when I go to foreign countries and stay in a hotel, I have to turn over my passport. I assume that you don't regard me as Taliban as a result.
No, Your Honor. And we simply make the point, as this court has made in numerous other cases, that it was standard practice when arriving at one of these guest houses en route to a training camp that you would surrender a passport. That was standard practice. It gave the proprietors of the guest house more control over the trainee and allowed them to dissuade somebody from leaving if, in fact, they wanted to encourage them to receive more training or do something else. We're not, you know, the fact he didn't have his passport by itself.
I thought the government's emphasis in other cases had been on the fact that the person left the passport for a very extended length of time, including after he left the guest house, and therefore giving Al-Qaeda or the Taliban control over his movements throughout the country and making exit more difficult.
Well, it does appear that petitioner, I believe there's a statement in the record that he then again turned it over to his host in Jalalabad after he moved there from the guest house in Kandahar. So that's not inconsistent with that. Even though the district court did find that the host in Jalalabad was not an Al-Qaeda guest house, it was somebody who is a veteran Taliban fighter, in fact, a close friend of the very person who originally told petitioner while in Yemen about training and fighting for the Taliban, and petitioner has admitted was his greatest influence in going to Afghanistan.
Well, he did lose control over his passport at one point.
Oh, yes.
And it makes a point of that to explain why he remained in one location as long as he did. What was the point at which he acknowledges losing control of his passport?
He admits he handed it over in Kandahar at the guest house.
At the guest house.
And then I believe he also stated that when he moved to Jalalabad, he again gave it, although I think he says it was for safekeeping out of trust for his host in Jalalabad.
So he got it back after the first guest house if he surrendered it at the second one. And then what? What about the third one?
I'm sorry?
What about the third guest house?
Well, remember, it was from Jalalabad that he fled east towards the mountainous border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan and was then eventually captured.
But the explanation for why he remained in a village for a very long time was he was waiting for his passport.
That is what petitioner said in various interrogation reports.
Right, and that would suggest that he did not have control over his passport.
That's correct.
So at what point did he lose it?
As I understand petitioner's statements from the interrogation reports, it's when he went to Jalalabad, he turned over his passport to his host there for safekeeping. And I don't think there's any indication he ever had it back after that.
It's a little bit unlike Judge Garland's experience in, let's say, Paris.
A little bit unlike that, yes, that's correct. That is correct. But I will note the district court found petitioner's story about his time in Jalalabad generally, and in particular about his time leading up to his arrest, to be vague as compared to very specific details of the rest of his time traveling throughout Afghanistan and in Yemen, and frankly found his story of the time spent leading up to capture not credible. And as this court has noted, false exculpatory statements can be often strong evidence supporting detention. So in addition to the training camp stays and to the guest house stays, we have the district court's detailed findings about petitioner's purposes for going to Afghanistan in the first place. Very briefly, those relied on, as I mentioned, a veteran Taliban fighter who told him about fighting and training in Afghanistan. And petitioner stated at page 788 that he was interested in that discussion of the training. It involved petitioner's admission, again, page 803 in the record, that he was influenced by a fatwa by clerics calling for men to go to Afghanistan specifically to assist the Taliban. The district court believed it was not credible, the suggestion that he would have gone, that the fatwa would have called for him to assist the Taliban in nonviolent means. And we submit that's a reasonable conclusion. The district court found that he had longstanding ties to Al-Qaeda members. That's demonstrated at page 818 in the record, that when petitioner was staying at the guest house in Afghanistan, he was able to send and receive messages at the front to a fighter who was one of the acquaintances he made in Sana'a and kept in contact with over the years. And he noted that the route traveled by petitioner from Yemen to Afghanistan was very similar. In fact, it's almost identical to the route in the Uthman case from Quetta to Kandahar to Kabul and eventually into Jalalabad. And then, as I noted, the court found that there were many false exculpatory statements. We submit that the district court did not err when viewing all the evidence as a whole together. All the district court had to rely upon here, in large part, were the statements, the interrogation reports from the petitioner himself, and in certain limited circumstances from other detainees. And in each circumstance, the judge weighed those against each other, found that the evidence was corroborated by other pieces in the record, and concluded it was more likely than not, indeed concluded he was compelled to hold that petitioner was part of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. The petitioner in this case did not testify at the hearing. He did not submit a declaration at the hearing. There was nothing other than legal arguments by counsel that certain facts should not be considered legally dispositive or attempts to undermine particular documents in the record. questioning their reliability. But the court was not faced with any contrary narrative from petitioner or any specific denials of any of these facts. Instead, he had the specific admissions from petitioner and, you know, a few generic denials in the interrogation reports, but certainly nothing that would make the findings clearly erroneous. We'd be happy to talk about any more questions in closed session or happy to answer any in open session if this court has any, but otherwise.
Okay, my colleagues, we appear don't have any more for open session. Okay. Mr. Neff, would you like more? Okay, fine. In that case, if you could close the courtroom, we'll take a brief recess and we'll do that. You can begin, Mr. Neff, you can begin as the first argument in closing.